what I find with the internet is where it has the potential to unite the world with common understanding and common knowledge, or at least diversified understanding and diversified knowledge. What's really happening out there is it's being used as a weapon.
Hello, and welcome to the sixth episode of NeoHuman. I'm Aga Bahari. You can find me at Agologist on Twitter and Instagram. And you can follow the show on iTunes or liveinlimbo.com. For the sixth episode, I'm here with my good friend, a writer who have lived many lives, I would say, Randall Willis. How are you?
Here. I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. You probably do a better job, as I tell every guest on the show, introducing yourself than me introducing you. So why don't you tell us a little about yourself and what have you done and what are you doing now?
Basically, I like to describe myself as a storyteller, mostly writing. I write science and medicine. I'm working as a screenwriter right now, also trying to be a novelist. And my background is biochemistry. I used to be a scientist. I used to know things. And strangely enough, I used to be able to do things. Now I just talk about things.
Now, when you say that you were a scientist and you used to know things.
Yep.
That's sarcasm or no?
A little bit. Basically.
All right, let's start from there then.
Okay. As a scientist, I used to actually know an incredible amount of information about practically nothing. So basically, as a protein biochemist, I worked at Sick Kids Hospital in Toronto and at the University of Toronto. And my job was to isolate proteins so other people could study them. Some of these proteins were involved in human disease. Others were just test systems so that the people understanding the structure could actually improve the structure tools that they were using. Mm-hmm. So what that meant was I knew everything that absolutely needed to be known about how to express those proteins in bacteria, sometimes how to actually subclone them into the bacteria so they could be expressed, and then every nuance of the purification protocols.
What kind of outcome did you see that was resulted because of that knowledge?
In a lot of cases, because I was in basic research, there was nothing as exciting as helping to create cures. One of the proteins I worked on was a part of the cystic fibrosis gene. And so there were no clinical applications to the work I was doing. Mm-hmm. That being said, we did get a better understanding of how certain sections of, say, again, the cystic fibrosis protein fold. And that gave a better understanding of what goes wrong when human genes are mutated for that segment, and so why the protein doesn't function the way it's supposed to. Downstream, hopefully, that gives people clues as to drug discovery or the development of other therapeutics based on the misfolding or the aggregation of those proteins in mm-hmm. human cells. I never got to work on anything as sexy as gene editing because it didn't exist then.
Well, you can start now because it's a very good time for that.
It is. And the nice thing there was I get to write about that and I don't have to worry about doing it.
Right.
It's a lot sexier to talk about these things than it is to actually try to do them. Doing them is a very frustrating job.
Right.
I used to say the funny thing about doing scientific research was it was one of the few jobs where you could be wrong 95% of the time. You could fail 95% of the time and you were having a good week.
Yeah, it's true.
It's totally true. Most of your experiments are failures, but all failure comes with learning if you're willing to learn.
Yeah, the startup world has a similar thing that you hear about this and that startup on a daily basis from many, many quote-unquote credible sources, and then they will be gone, and you won't see any trace of them left in a couple of months because this is just difficult. There are so many steps on the way.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, and even what's successful today may not be successful in 10 years.
That's true.
Which is why reading a business book that's more than, about an hour and a half old is really meaningless. Unless you look at it in broad terms.
Unless you're Donald Trump. which means a business book that you wrote is the second most important book in the history.
Yes, and I'm surprised he only listed it as second most. Because really, what, you know, how many people have actually quoted the Bible in a business meeting?
That's right. You know, they probably do it in Congress.
Except at Armageddon time.
You know? In Congress and Senate, I think they're using.
Yeah, apparently there have been layoffs. They're down to two horsemen of the apocalypse now. They're riding on two smaller horses.
And an aircraft carrier.
There you go.
Then you moved to writing for medical journals?
Basically I moved while I was still a research person. Somebody foolishly let me work on a newsletter. And I like to think of myself as also a humorist, which is basically I'm an asshole that doesn't take anything very seriously.
Right.
And so I would write a lot of jokes about what a crappy lifestyle it was. And that said, oh my goodness, I can talk about stuff and not actually be responsible for doing anything.
Yeah.
I love writing. And so that moved me into publishing. And so ultimately I ended up moving down to the Washington DC area and worked for the American Chemical Society.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
How long was that?
I did that for about 5 years. It was right around 2000.
How did you like Washington?
I didn't like it at the time. I actually think it's a fascinating and wonderful city now, but at the time I was rapidly homesick for Toronto. Because it was a new environment. It was artificial. The thing about Washington is there's a core of people who've lived there their entire lives, and everyone else, because of government and military, is transient.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard to establish friendships there, except with the people that are local, because they don't go anywhere. They don't move.
A lot of politics.
Well, the whole town is politics. I worked about seven blocks away from the White House.
Yeah.
So I would see it every morning. And Jed Bartlett was my president, because West Wing just made so much more sense than actual American politics to me. But yeah, so we were there for about 5 years. We were there during 9/11. That was kind of weird.
How was that experience?
I was on my way to a conference in Baltimore, taking the local train up there. And my wife and I had actually gotten onto the subway. We lived in the suburbs, had gotten onto the metro system at the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. If we'd been there an hour later, we would have been in the news for all the wrong reasons. And so that was surreal, knowing that our lives would have been significantly different by being an hour later going to work, or if the plane had come an hour earlier. And then I wasn't sure I wasn't going to be trapped in Baltimore, ironically wandering around the World Trade Center in Baltimore Harbor.
That's
and suddenly going, okay, this was a bad idea. but luckily I did manage to catch the last train home. And my wife at the time worked at Washington Hospital Center, which was like the crisis center for all the injuries coming out of the Pentagon and what have you. It was the big trauma hospital in town, still is, as far as I know. And so she was kind of, they actually let, because she works in IT, not in healthcare specifically, they actually let her go. Go home. It was a way of getting extraneous people out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was actually, I think, worse for my family in not in Washington or not in New York, because all they saw was what was on the news, and they knew we were in Washington, that we took the subway from the Pentagon. And so most of my family were freaking out here in Toronto and the suburbs, of just trying to figure out, like, are you alive? Are you okay? The next couple of weeks of working in Washington were surreal, simply because of the military vehicles that were at every street corner, soldiers with guns. This was something you saw on the news that happened in another country. This wasn't something that happened on your way to work. I was never really scared. It was just surreal. It was like being in a story I might write.
Did you write any story based on that?
The reason I was in Baltimore was I was covering a conference, and so I had to write a review of that conference.
Hmm.
And so I ended up writing a review that talked about the response of everyone at the conference to the events as they unfolded. Because we were watching them, you know, some of the vendor companies had giant TV screens that they would be showing their instrumentation and what have you. Those quickly got changed over to CNN.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so we're
I would imagine business will be in general just out of window a day like that.
Oh yeah, totally. It was within moments of figuring out that this was something big. When the planes were striking the towers in New York, because I think the Pentagon didn't get nearly the airplay until everyone, you know, it was more what was going on in New York. But yeah, we were standing around watching this. And again, because it was on a giant TV screen at a conference, it was like watching a TV show. It was very difficult to actually go, this is actually happening. And so what ended up happening was when I finally got back to work and finally got home, was I ended up writing about that, much to the chagrin of the people that ran the conference who were like, no, we're still running a conference here. Mm-hmm. But I checked with my boss and my editor, and he was like, no, that's what you experienced. And that's, it was interesting that there was a sense of duty, a sense of responsibility to record, in many respects, the good that came out of that as far as people coming together, people opening their doors. And that even though, you know, I'm a human before I'm a Canadian, regardless of what it may sound like at times. And so even as a Canadian, even as someone who was witnessing something going on in another country where I just accidentally happened to be living at the time, I felt it was a responsibility to talk about the people and how they came together in the chaos of not really knowing what to do, because there wasn't anything to do. But it was, I mean, despite the tragedy that triggered it, it was an incredibly beautiful moment in American history because of that. And I think in world history, it was a time everybody came together on one
it's
level.
It's true. I was in Iran, and I remember I got this phone call from my friend at the time, who was a drummer. We talked about him at the book that we're writing, and we're going to talk about that too. And then he said a plane hit a building in New York, and I was like, well, you know, I don't think anybody took it that seriously with the first plane, because nobody knew what the size was.
Exactly.
The circumstances on that. A lot of people thought it is a movie. But then when the second one hit, that everybody knew that the United States is under attack. And up to this day, that night was one of the nights that I was really happy that I'm Iranian in comparison with a lot of countries around us, because we were seeing on a satellite, Euronews and a whole bunch of other networks, that like people in Palestine and Gaza, they're celebrating. They, you know, spreading hugs and handshakes and, you know, cheerings, and they were happy about that. But what happened in Tehran that night was that a lot of people gathered in a square and light the candle, and it was in solidarity to Americans. And I thought it was just wonderful. It was just really, like what you're saying, that it brought people together. It definitely was one of those moments. And it was amazing because it was something that had happened, you know, across the world. Right. Fear also was a part of it, I would imagine, because it was like, oh, they're going to blame Iran also. You know, we were on top of shit news on a daily basis, as we still are. And but then the president of Iran at the time gave a
press conference?
Not really a press conference. It was more like, you know, when the president of the U.S. addressing people.
Oh, okay. Like a state
like
of the
my
union.
My fellow Americans. Yes. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. So that kind of a deal, but Iranian version, you know, send condolences to American people and American government. All that's a good move. But things change when they attack Afghanistan, because there were a lot of fear, but from the perspective of a government of Iran, there were a lot of opportunities because they were hitting the enemy of the Iranian government.
Right.
But anyways, you mentioned that your editor gave you the freedom to write about whatever you want. I would imagine seeking this freedom was the main reason for you to decide that I have had enough with working for the man, and I'm just going to write my own stuff from now on. Is that true?
To some extent, it's true, yeah. So basically, what Agah is referring to is essentially, after several years of working for magazines, different magazines, usually oriented with science or medicine. I worked for an advertising agency for several years here in Toronto doing medical advertising, and I still freelance for it. I decided that I wanted to work on my own stuff, and that was really the move for me into screenwriting and novel writing and that type of thing, creating my own stories, creating things based on what was going on in my head. Longer form stuff, because I had been doing comedy writing and sketch comedy writing for a while. Whether you thought it was funny is your own problem. But I thought it was funny, and so I was writing it. But yeah, it was very much about the freedom. It was about no longer spinning my wheels on a lot of things. Unlike the United States and unlike the United States and New Zealand for every country, there are tight regulations on medical writing for advertising. Mm-hmm. We cannot advertise to consumers. That's why we don't have Cymbalta ads with floating butterflies and a long stream of side effects on our TV sets
right.
in the evening. Assuming anyone has a TV set anymore. And so, you know, I joke with people, and yet it's entirely serious, that I became a medical ad writer as a medicine guy, and in the process became a lawyer, because I spent all my time arguing code, regulatory code, about what we could and could not say. I would spend weeks arguing the word "the" mm-hmm. when describing something. And so that really wears on you, because you're no longer, as much as I became a creative director at this agency, the true creativity was coming up with something new within the context of
right.
pleasing your client, who is a product manager who may only have that job for 3 months, and needs sales now, and getting through the regulatory process, which was sort of more, not quite government run. It wasn't Health Canada, but Health Canada informed the process a lot. And so again, I now have the ability to do a deep dive on any therapeutic area. Mm-hmm. I can become an expert in any medical area, within days, because historically I've had to. You know, give me a prescription pad, I could tell you what to try. The science background really helps on that too, so I can explain later why it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But again, that's kind of, I love that aspect. I also love trying to be creative with it, but by the same token, being in perpetual handcuffs creatively was just a real drag on the spirit.
It's a business.
It's totally business. And that was part of my learning curve too, was again, you've got brand managers and product managers who again need sales next quarter. And you know, coming from the creative side, and coming from the science and medicine side, I knew what I wanted to talk about, but I also had to fulfill their needs. And that was kind of a maturation thing for me, was to understand that and to really understand, because they're my client.
Mm-hmm.
You know, regardless of what we might think, the patient at the end of the process is not my client.
Yeah.
We will do what we can to communicate as well as we can. The ups and downs. We will be as honest as we possibly can and still try to achieve a goal. And that's why usually when people find out I've been in medical advertising, or still am, and they jump down my throat that's just entirely wrong. It's like, we're not criminals. We are trying to tell a story. We are, yes, trying to promote a brand, but that's where the money comes from.
And also, that's your job.
That's my job.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do as good a job as I can within the limitations also of the medicine. Because the thing is, we're basing a lot of our statements on clinical trials that have happened in the past, and we have to talk about it in that population, this worked. We cannot say it will therefore work for you. Mm-hmm. But so often those clinical trials are really limited. I've based something on a clinical trial that only involved 400 bush pilots in Manitoba, because that was the only study that was available. So if you're not a bush pilot in northern Manitoba, I don't know that this will work for you.
Right.
Realistically, I don't know.
But it's being prescribed.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's the thing too, is, you know, what I like to joke about with people is that healthcare is statistical. It's based on populations of patients, and 72% of a population may see the benefit of a certain drug. But the problem is, your health and my health are individual. It's personal. So, you know, if I give you the drug that worked for 72% of the population, that does not mean 72% of your body will respond positively. Mm-hmm. It's really binary. And actually, it's not even that simple. I wish it were binary. Yes, it worked. No, it didn't. Inevitably, it kind of works or mostly doesn't, or sometimes maybe works really well for you, but it doesn't work for your cousin who has maybe a very similar genetic background and lifestyle, and yet for whatever reason doesn't work.
Now, this whole industry being based in business, as are all other industries. Mm-hmm.
And I would argue even government healthcare is a business.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The biggest, slowest, and shittiest business, I would say.
Biggest expenditure in the United States from a government perspective is healthcare.
Well, I think everything should be privatized, and government basically should be so small that we are only dealing really with defense and, you know.
Then you should vote for Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Let's not start American politics yet.
I know.
Yeah.
But what do you think is a motivation, or maybe motivation is not the right word, but what is the need to come up with actual cure rather than make something that cause maybe solve two of your problems, but create two more? So you will have to buy another medicine that will address that, you know, the new two problems, right, which by itself create two more.
There is a strong argument being made in the general population that, for example, cancer. I'm going to be going to a cancer conference in a couple months, and there is a strong argument being made that companies are just trying to make cancer a lifestyle disease.
Right.
Right. We're not looking for a cure for cancer. We just want to keep you alive long enough that you keep buying the drug.
It's a great business for them.
It is. But the funny thing is,
the treatment side, what will happen to the people who invested millions and billions of dollars on providing the treatment side of cancer? I would imagine those people are strong enough to lobby against coming up with a cure.
I don't see it that way. One, I think a cure for anything is tricky. It's going to be very difficult to come up with a cure for a lot of these diseases because they can happen spontaneously.
Yeah.
Or you can be genetically predisposed to certain medical issues. But aside from that, you know, a lot of companies are, what they're really good at is taking one product they've developed for one disease and finding out where else it can be used. Right. So there's always going to be a market. I worked on a drug targeting, monoclonal antibody targeting rheumatoid arthritis. And it not only covered rheumatoid arthritis, but it covered a lot of auto-inflammatory diseases, or autoimmune diseases, I should say. So psoriasis, inflammatory bowel disease, and that type of thing. Because a lot of these diseases have similar root causes. Mm-hmm. You know, when you target a specific molecule on a cell, could be a cell surface receptor or something, nature has this beautiful way of taking one thing and making it do 27 different things, depending on what organ it's expressed in, depending on how old you are. You know, a protein that does one thing when you're a fetus can do another thing when you're an infant, can do a completely different thing when you're a senior, even in the same cell. And so inevitably, when you develop a drug, or whether that's a protein biologic or a gene therapy or a whatever, or a small molecule, inevitably, it has other effects. Now, those that are beneficial, we call treatment. Those that are not beneficial, we call side effects. Mm-hmm. And they're all kind of triggered by the same problem of you're throwing something at a biological system that has all these redundant pathways. And so what you end up doing is kind of screwing up the entire body.
What do you think about gene editing?
I think gene editing is fascinating. I think it's got a lot of potential, especially now with the new technologies. I think it's really tricky. I not too long ago wrote a feature about that for one of the magazines I work for. And like the CRISPR technology, that's Nobel Prize winning. If it doesn't win a Nobel Prize, it's only because something even more astounding showed up next month.
Explain CRISPR technology.
Oh, yeah, sorry. CRISPR technology, basically, it's like all good biomedical science. It's a protein a nucleic acid combination. It's a complex that can go in and very accurately cut two ends of a piece of DNA. And you can target that to decide what DNA. And basically you can throw in the sort of, say you want to change a mutant, a mutation. You could throw in the correct version, and on a decently accurate scale, it will substitute the correct version for the damaged version. So in theory, if you had something like a leukemia, you could pull out that has one mutation in it, you could conceivably pull out bone marrow stem cells, modify those stem cells to replace the damaged gene for the healthy version, and put those stem cells back into a patient and effectively cure the disease. That's where you're going to see cures. The challenge being, again, so often, and this is where I'm cautious, some may call me pessimistic, I'm cautious. The challenge is it's not 100% accurate. So you may substitute that piece of DNA in the wrong spot, which may cause a cascade of other effects. And also it can be, again, the body still does things that we can't control. And we also don't always know, the downstream impacts of changing a gene. Because again, going back to what I was saying earlier, nature has this way of making one thing do many functions.
Very slowly, though, and through a process of trial and error. So,
which, getting back to the beginning, was a lot of error and some.
Yeah, it's true. I would imagine one of the possibilities that came up because of a Human Genome Project is the rise of designer babies, which means that you will be able to design the genetics of an unborn fetus, and then you will have a supposedly perfect baby.
Whatever your definition of perfect is.
Well, perfect for the environment that that baby is in, right?
One day we should be so smart, yes.
Yeah, well, how far do you think are we from that? And do you think that that would be a good thing to do? Because imagine that we will be... like a new generation is going to be, let's say, 500 million in the next couple of years. And then 500 million people with identical genetics. Would that help at all? Or no, it makes no sense. And what is the possibility of that? Because then you will be able to come up with a treatment that is very specific to that specific kind of genome.
I think in the long run, I really hesitate to say whether it's going to be good or bad, because it doesn't really matter what I think, to be honest with you. It will happen. Those experiments will be done, even though there is a large scale moratorium, right now on actually making, the Brits recently said it was okay to experiment on human embryos, but those embryos could not be ever implanted to turn into a human baby.
Well, I mean...
at the moment.
Yeah, here's the thing, though. I see that there are a lot of opposition against these new technologies. A lot of it is in the United States because of the religious forces that they do have. Because the main argument from that side is that you can't fuck with what God has done or God has planned for you.
Right.
Or those kind of thing. But at the same time...
And yet, ironically, those people fly in airplanes.
That's right. Yes. Exactly. Or using internet to bash technology, for example.
It's just a series of tubes. It's okay.
Yeah. But at the same time, a country like China, they don't have any kind of these restrictions. And they're very...
Well, and ironically, it was a Chinese group that kind of triggered this recent cascade of navel-gazing and thinking about things. The challenge is, like, I agree with you, and that's in many respects, that's why I think it's going to be inevitable. People are going to do these experiments, whether they're sanctioned or not.
Yeah. And it's getting easier and easier and cheaper and cheaper.
Well, in theory, you could do it at home now.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You will have a lot of...
you can buy the kit.
Citizen scientists that, you know, experimenting with a whole bunch of different stuff in their basement.
Yeah.
With a normal computer.
The challenge being you got to sit there with a petri dish underneath your wife while she ovulates. And I can't speak to your wife. I know you're not married, but I'm pretty sure my ex-wife would say no. But yes, it is possible that you'll get these citizen scientists. Inevitably, somebody's going to be working on this stuff. The one thing I would add to your thought on the idea that the hesitation in the U.S. is religious, it's not strictly religious. Science has a long history of taking a cautionary moment. Back in the early 70s, when molecular biology was being effectively invented, and you could actually take fragments of DNA and subclone them into bacteria for expression or that kind of thing, or change the genetic makeup. So in many respects, gene editing is not new. It's just we're really good at it now.
Yeah.
They took a moment and they said, hold it. Let's get together. Some of the top scientists in the world, no handful of Nobel laureates. Already at that point, got together in Asilomar, California, because why would you get together in Chicago in the winter? It's terrible. So they got together in this beautiful resort in California, and they said, let's talk about this. And they brought in ethicists. They brought in regulators. They brought in not just scientists, because even they said, scientists are a little hyper-enthusiastic. If we think we can do it, we're going to try to do it. Mm-hmm. So let's bring in other voices. And that's effectively what happened in the U.S. not a couple months ago on this whole gene editing and more importantly, embryo editing, which is kind of where you were going. And the same kind of meeting happened in the U.K. and they said, okay, but with these conditions. So scientists every once in a while do kind of want to pause and say, what are the implications of this? Do we know enough to really unleash this ability to do something? Again, I personally, through my own personal experience, and what I've written about for decades, they're going to do it. It's how quickly they embrace it and how slowly they decide to walk down
the road. At the same time, it's directly related to your competitor. It's the reason that, you know, a lot of technologies started arising in 20th century. It was because of war.
Yeah.
You know, atomic bomb was built because of war, and then a lot of other things came as a consequence
of that. The internet came from DARPA.
Exactly. And then we went to the space because of the Cold War.
Yep.
Yeah. So this is what I'm saying. If China is doing it, a lot of this, the arguments by ethicists and regulators and religious side and all those people will go out of a window, because there are a lot of money to be made from new technologies. But at the same time, it's a matter of superiority. It's like, you know, a United States has how many thousands of nuclear bombs? It's very hard to imagine that they will use any of it, but they're in the nuclear club and they want to be number one. And that's what I'm talking about, that if China is doing it much faster than United States is doing it now, United States has to be that fast, or Canada has to become that fast to compete with them. And that will throw out a lot of other secondary thing out of window. Mm-hmm.
The trick is, though, because of the societies we live in, I can't speak to China, I've never lived in China, but the societies we live in Canada, the United States, most of Europe, if not all of Europe, the trick is you still need an infrastructure to deal with the mistakes that are going to happen, especially in human experimentation.
Oh, for sure.
And so that becomes very much the question of what is your ethical responsibility to all the failures that happen before you get it right, right? And also there are, again, getting back to this sense of what is today's definition of perfect, you know? It seems like a no-brainer to say that, you know, if you know that you have a family history of cystic fibrosis, and if you can, from a single cell in a brand new embryo, determine that this embryo is going to develop cystic fibrosis based on its mutational profile, well, yeah, it's a no-brainer. You go in and if you can fix that, you go in and fix that. The trick becomes when it becomes more whatever somebody decides is a lifestyle change. We want a baby that's more intelligent than the next baby. But the challenge I will throw out to you is, and it's undoubtedly just a matter of time, is we're not smart enough yet to know what's involved in intelligence. You know, it's not necessarily a genetics.
Well,
there's also epigenetics. But the problem is, even if you experiment, even if you know the right genes, even if, say, there are seven genes that instill human intelligence, inevitably, or are correlated with human intelligence, there are also so many other factors of biology, like epigenetics, which can be, if we have a particularly sunny year, can change the way genes are expressed in our body. It can be what air we're breathing, whether I live in Toronto or whether I live in Tuktoyaktuk, where I'm assuming the air is a little bit cleaner than it is in Toronto, or Detroit, or if you're drinking the river water in Flint, Michigan. Those are all going to have significant impacts on our biology. So in a lot of respects, it's always going to be a crapshoot. Science is a complete crapshoot at the best of times, because we just don't have enough information. Now, does this mean we have to wait until we do? No, because science wouldn't exist if we waited until we had enough information.
What do you think about the notion that some people are suggesting we're not coming up with cure for diseases like, well, AIDS is the biggest one, because the majority of the patients and majority of the people with AIDS are living in Africa and they have no money, so there are no money to be made from those people.
Right. The thing is, and to some extent, I do believe that is true. Not so much the idea that we're not coming up with a cure because the majority of people live there, but more that there's less impetus to treat those people because there's no money in it. And, you know, but there are good people in science, let me be quick to throw out there, who specifically have those environments in mind or those populations in mind to create really inexpensive treatments or really inexpensive diagnostic tools that can be used in the field that don't require refrigeration and infrastructure or hospitals. There's amazing, and I love talking about that science, because that's the much more, in my head, what science is supposed to be.
Yeah.
What I would say, though, is yes, sort of to echo the sentiment that Africa is a secondary consideration at best in the current scenario, is that yes, until affluent white people started coming down with HIV or started getting infected with HIV, yeah, there was less impetus to develop the very expensive cocktails of drugs. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing on cures, again, is you got to remember that a big part of the challenge of a lot of these things is infectious disease in particular, is that these things mutate massively and quickly. And so to say you're going to wipe out an entire species, because that's what HIV is. It is a species. It is effectively a life form, yeah. Right? Same as Zika virus. It is a life form. To say you're going to be able to wipe out an entire species, we're good at the macro level. We can kill off the dodo, no problem. But when it comes to microbes that reproduce massively quickly and are so adaptable to new populations of targets, it's going to be hard to do that. And I'm not saying it's going to be impossible, but it's things like vaccination programs. So, you know, effectively eliminating smallpox, effectively eliminating polio, until people said, well, hey, those are taken care of. I don't need to vaccinate anymore. And we could do another hour just on that. And so that becomes, but again, we felt we eradicated smallpox and it comes back. We felt we eradicated polio. It's still there. Mm-hmm. The plague, the bubonic plague, is still there. We can still sing Ring Around the Rosie. You know, the plague still exists. Microbes are incredibly capable of finding ways around everything we try, which again gets us back to cancer. Cancer is the same thing. It's growing so rapidly. It's fact-checking machinery to make sure replication is perfect is kind of turned off or turned down, right. Which is why a treatment will work for a while, but then it'll stop working because you've killed off the cells that are sensitive, but there's always those one or two that remain. And that's why I think the new, what's called immunotherapies, where you're actually bolstering the natural immune system of the patient to help it recognize the tumor. That's the exciting thing that's going on right now, because when it works, they're actually using the C word at cancer conferences, cure. Mm-hmm. Because you can effectively eliminate the cancer based on what we've seen so far. I mean, in truth, this is so new that we really need to watch these patients for the next, well, until they die and see if the cancer ever comes back before we can truly say they were cured. But it's looking damn good. And this is really exciting
stuff. I'm very optimistic about it too. I mean, everything is suggesting that we are heading towards a much better place.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's always a militarized side, a side of all of this advancement. So we figure out a cure, we probably make 10 bioweapon based on that understanding and unleash it on, you know, some other people.
Sure.
Some other part of the world that we might not even hear about it.
Yep. Well, we gotta stockpile them for the alien invasion.
Too, that's right. We have to be ready.
Because that's how War of the Worlds ended.
Alien invasion or second coming of Jesus.
Either way,
yeah. Might be the same thing.
Could be the same thing. It might have been the same thing the first time around. I really don't know. I know I haven't been particularly good enough based on my interpretation of the Bible, so I'm going to hell anyways. So
yeah.
I don't really have a problem with that.
Hell seems to be much funner.
Well, I'll have a lot of really good company. I know that. Very interesting company in hell. So
yeah, I'll take hell too. Let's talk a little bit about what have you done since you decided that you're just going to work on your own ideas.
Okay. So that got me into screenwriting. And again, as I said before, you know, I come from, I studied at Second City, doing improv and got into sketch writing, tried stand-up comedy, hats off to anyone who does it, because that's the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. And so, to give you a sense of how I approach screenwriting, I sit in a room and I look at my notepad. I write longhand. I'm old. And basically I come up with as many stupid ideas as I can and see which one jazzes me that day. I am not really good about planning things out ahead of time. And so my very first screenplay was actually a joke I didn't know what to do with for 4 years. And I don't throw anything away. I'm also a hoarder. And so flipping through an old notebook, I saw this joke and immediately a story clicked into my head. It's a really silly joke. I am a punster. I like puns. I'm bad at it. Well, I'm good at it, which is bad. And so the joke was, if you remember from, I think it was Rocky II,
no, I don't.
James Brown sang a song, Living in America.
That's Rocky IV, I think.
Was that Rocky IV? Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Okay. It was one of the 27 Rockies. And so James Brown sang Living in America. It was very sis boom ba. It was everything that you love and hate about America. So one day I was watching a rerun of that movie because that's how sad TV was at that day. And all of a sudden in my head, I heard Living in an aquarium. And so suddenly in my brain, I'm like, wow, that's really funny. I don't know what to do with it. So 4 years later, I'm sitting there, I read the same line in my notebook, and I'm like, oh, a love story in a pet store. This Romeo and Juliet takes place in a pet shop. Mm-hmm. And I have no qualms about publicly expressing what I wrote, for fear of someone will steal it. I'd be flattered if somebody would steal this. And so it's very much, it's a love story between a saltwater fish and a freshwater fish, the love that can never be, in a pet store. And so I sat down and based on a weekend workshop on screenwriting, I still curse the instructor there because he showed me that I could write a 100-page screenplay when I'd only ever written a 5-page sketch. And so I sat there and using that, I just kind of wrote out a story that just tickled my heart and was a lot of fun about dancing and singing fish, mm-hmm. which I'm thinking pretty much has to be animated because it's so hard to train fish. But that gave me the bug. I was still working when I wrote that screenplay, and I would do it on the weekends. Eventually, like I say, the job in medical advertising just killed me at some point, killed my soul. And so I spent 6 months online basically riding through northern Italy on Google Street View. Which if you can't travel, Google Street View is pretty good, actually.
It is pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. And
especially with virtual reality, we got this headset, yeah, which you can buy for like $25-$30
yeah,
online. And that has Google Street View in it. And it's just amazing.
Yeah.
You just sit there and it's just unbelievable. What happened to that screenplay, that the screenplay that you were talking, the Saltfish?
And so, yeah, it went into a few competitions, different film festivals that had screenwriting competitions. It did okay. It got some recognition. It was usually a quarter finalist. It was sort of a stepping off point. It really informed the next few screenplays I wrote. One was a murder thriller that I love, but I need to redo it before I submit it to anything. I have another holiday themed, Santa Goes to War, screenplay that I wrote most recently. It's kind of, I describe it as the Santa Claus meets Good Morning Vietnam. It's an adult story. This will freak out the kids if you, not a horror, it's just Santa in a war zone, just is a little weird. That one actually won, semi-finalist for Francis Ford Coppola's American Zoetrope competition. Mm-hmm. Just that close to being actually read by Francis Ford Coppola. Because I would have changed Good Morning Vietnam into Apocalypse Now at a heartbeat if I thought Ford Coppola was going to be reading it. I go back to Tanks, the aquarium, the pet store story. That one actually won in Nashville for mm-hmm. the animated category. I was quite pleased with that.
Yeah.
Because now on my resume and pretty much everywhere, I haven't quite had it tattooed on my body yet. I can say award-winning screenwriter. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where until somebody else says you're really good, like that, winning an award, it's hard to convince anybody else that you're
That's
really
true. Good. That's very true. The names of organizations that you are related to somehow definitely helps a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, it's like anything. It's like I say, it's until somebody else, nobody wants to take a flyer. And in their defense,
there are millions of people doing the same thing.
Exactly. These guys are inundated, and I mean gender neutral guys are inundated with hundreds of scripts a day.
Yeah.
I mean, if they get past the first page, that's impressive. Which is really frightening. So if your advice for wannabe screenwriters, make that first page kick ass.
Yeah.
Because that may be all they're reading.
I think it's true with everything. I read the Santa one, not completely, the first right. page of Santa one. The first time I met you, I think.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty close, yeah.
And it was a couple of months after that, maybe 2-3 months after that, throughout a series of conversations and events and everything that I thought that you would be the right person to write this novel that I had in my mind as right. well, which was 2013, I believe.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It has been a long time. And we worked on that novel for about 2 years, and then the rest of it is my fault that it's been...
It's totally your fault.
It is. It's been delayed that long. So why don't you speak a little yeah. about that novel? Because...
The novel that has changed titles several times.
That's right.
Is effectively, the way I describe it to people is it is a semi-biographical novel of a guy's life. Childhood, growing up, and sort of an escape from Iran story. But it's more than that. And God knows what it is now because a guy's been rewriting it. but yeah. basically, and I say semi-biographical because we don't necessarily stick a 1,000% to the very fact of what happened, because that's inevitably much more boring. But we met through friends, and I've always been attracted, not sexually, calm down, always been attracted to your free spirit. And so the idea that this, what I've always known as this free-spirited artistic soul coming out of my image, my Western image of Iran, that story writes itself in my head. Yeah. Turns out I was wrong. It took about a year for the actual writing. So Aga and I sat down and we basically chatted. Thank God I've got a background in doing interviews. We chatted for almost 6 months of weekly interviews and hours and hours of conversation that I went through. Never in order. And from that, I tried to distill a story of what his childhood was like, what his growth and maturation was like. One day we hope the maturation will kick in. What his journey to the new land was like. And what struck me so often, and we talked about this a lot during the process, was how often our lives were parallel. Mm-hmm. Considering I grew up in Toronto and its suburbs, you grew up in Iran, and yet there were kids are kids, right? They go through a lot of the same processes, regardless of what environment they grow up in. You know, you were very free-spirited. I was very free-spirited. You played football, as the rest of the world knows it, soccer, as the Americans and Canadians know it, in the streets. I played road hockey. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just every once in a while, the cars in your neighborhood would explode. No, I kid. ours would just not function and try to run us over. So it was an amazing process for me. So, you know, regardless of what happens with the novel when it is completed and what audience it finds, I'm incredibly glad and honored that I went through the process with you because yeah, it likewise. Taught me and so much.
I can't say grueling for me because I realize that I cannot be a writer for life to make a living out of it. It's very interesting though, and it's a long process. It goes through many different stages. Mm-hmm. We finished our first draft, which is the first thing that you finished basically about a year ago.
Yeah.
Which is around 700 pages, and then we decided that is just like very long.
Well, it was overly detailed.
Yeah. And I'm trying to bring it down
right
to around 350 pages. So like half of it basically, which is a very hard thing to do, to take out parts, but yet, you know, connect right. the two sides of those taken out parts. But we're getting there,
to your credit, you are a better writer than you think you are.
Oh.
It's just, I think you're, like most people, you're intimidated by the end point, because you got to get somewhere. And this is one thing that I learned as a writer was, screw the end point, ignore the end, just write. Write however you want to write, is fundamentally. Yeah. And so I think what's made it easier is I took the stab at the first draft, so it gives you something to work from.
Yeah, well, that's been very helpful. And it always reminds me of something that Christopher Hitchens was saying, that he heard it from someone that writes the way that you talk.
Yeah.
So to get to that point by itself, it's a lot of work to be comfortable and confident enough with that. But you learn a lot throughout the process. And
totally.
Yeah, it's been amazing. And I'm definitely interested to write more, but it's just hard to look at myself as I have to wake up every morning and do this for a job. I didn't think that I can do that.
That's what I've come to though in the last, I guess it's been about 3 years since I jumped off the cliff of sort of North American norms of work till you die. It's not a job. It's like, I have no choice. I have to write.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not necessarily even with a goal in mind, which may be why I haven't produced a ton of stuff, it's a passion, right? It's a creative passion. And I think that's the key. You're a creative person. So regardless of what vehicle you use, you're going to naturally lean towards certain things that you're most comfortable with at one point in your life. And maybe still it was music. For me, it was the written word. And so every day I may accomplish nothing. Sorry, just did air quotes. Not easy to show that on a podcast. I may accomplish nothing and yet I've written all day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It could be a tweet. I can have days where I am happy if I put together the best fucking tweet that anyone wrote that day.
Yeah.
140 characters is a hell of a, 140 characters, hell of a discipline. To be able to say something coherent.
Oh, for sure.
But by the same token, I can write for 100 pages. I did what's called NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, a couple of years ago. And the target there is to write 50,000 words. They can be the word the 50,000 times, but it's not going to make for a good story. But the idea is to get you writing. And you can chart your progress and compare yourselves to everybody else who's writing. I ended up writing 80,000 on a story that's been sitting in my head for 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. And finally, it was like, damn it, I'm going to do this month. And I wrote 80,000 words.
So in 1 month.
In one month. And the story still needs work. I still have to work on the central plot. But the idea was write until you can't write anymore. And then put it away and do something else. I do photography.
Yeah.
I do amateur photography.
I found photography to be much more enjoyable than writing for me at this point.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, writing is, it's awesome. It's more of a necessity. I mean, I like this medium much better, talking.
Right.
Right? Because it's spontaneous. I don't edit the show unless somebody throw up or something. Then I have to cut that throwing up part.
So far, so good.
It's so far, so good. But writing, I don't know. Maybe I fall in love with it in a couple of years again.
And maybe you don't.
Maybe I don't. Yeah, maybe I don't. But it's interesting nevertheless.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question that I'm asking everybody at the end of the show.
And luckily, I've heard the podcast, so I know what's coming.
So you might have thought about it before.
Yeah.
That if you come across an intelligent alien from a different civilization, what would you say as the worst thing humanity has done? And what would you say as the best thing that humanity has achieved?
Yeah. Yes, I have given it some thought. And I would say, perhaps not surprisingly, given what the bulk of this conversation is about, I'll start with the best thing, which I think is recorded communication. All species communicate in whatever mechanism they use to communicate with their environment. But humans are the only one that I'm aware of so far that have actually determined the mechanism to record what they're communicating. And what that means is I can learn from things that happened 2,000 years ago, even outside of the Bible. And I don't have to take it damn literally. Whereas before, I would have to sit around and have somebody tell me what was going on, tell me long stories. Homer did it. That was all oral communication until centuries later when somebody actually said, oh, hey, we got these squiggly little things in the clay tablets. Let's write it down.
Now, don't forget where you're going. It's interesting because there's a documentary about this American priest who goes to Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it's Sweden or all around Scandinavia. And talking to people about religion, I find out that most people in those countries are atheists. They don't believe in at least Jesus.
Right.
And his mind is blown because that's not what he understood about the world overall. But he come across some guy in Sweden who started a religion based on copying. So he says that copying is sacred because this is how we got here, which is basically what you were saying. But based on, even if you write something, you have to make a copy of that to make it available to other people and preserve it. So I found that interesting.
What I find interesting about that, the idea of the sacredness of copying, is the fact that historically we're terrible at it. Because much like our own DNA, things mutate based on the environment, based on where we are and who we are at that time. When you look at translations, the challenge of written communication is it sucks at expressing sarcasm. Just as an example, I could write something and you don't know if I'm being sarcastic or if I'm, because there's no intonation. We've come up with emojis and emoticons, but that's not really working either.
Not there yet.
So ironically, emojis and emoticon are really just new age cave painting.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, because I can do an emoticon or whatever it's called of an ice cream cone, and just because I like ice cream. And much as someone several tens of thousands of years ago spit on the back of their hand to go, look, I have a hand. Or I killed that really distorted wildebeest. We're doing the same thing now with the internet. I find that amazingly hilarious.
Yeah.
But that's just because I'm weird that way.
What's the worst thing we've done?
Okay, I'm going to go completely contrary to what you might expect and what many people that you've had on your podcast.
I have no expectations.
Then you know me well. the internet. While this may sound exactly opposite of what I just said a second ago about the best thing, I think therein lies the crux, is that the greatest thing we've ever invented from my perspective that no other species has done on our planet is also the greatest bane we have. Because what I find, and we could argue this happened with books too, before the internet, what I find with the internet is where it has the potential to unite the world with common understanding and common knowledge, or at least diversified understanding and diversified knowledge. What's really happening out there is it's being used as a weapon. It's causing people to not share, but so much as to narrow down their existence. And I'm as guilty as the next guy, right? I read what I like to read. I go to the sites that agree with my personal view of the universe. I don't challenge myself enough. And so I think that's one of the challenges of the internet, is because there's no quote fact checking, and that's an entirely different podcast. I find it's become a weapon in society to be able to separate out people, not share, it's reduced the plurality, ironically, by democratizing information. Any idiot can write anything, and that includes me. And no one's there. If you personally agree with it, then now we're setting up a clan of people who believe something. And we have it in writing, which strangely enough seems to verify it. And so to me, that's one of the challenges. I don't think the internet per se, it's a tool. So it is not evil. It's how we use it and how we abuse it, which you could argue is the same for anything that's been invented. So that's kind of where I'm sitting, is it's like, as contrary as it sounds to say the greatest thing and the worst thing are the same thing, it is so much in who we are and how we use it.